Could be cancerous, couldn't it? She asked. A little reluctantly, I said that it might be. I explained that I would get a frozen section during the operation, a specimen to be examined immediately by a pathologist. If he reported that the tumour was not cancerous, I would not have to try to get every last little bit of tumour out, and if it was a tumour called a germinoma, I wouldn't have to remove it at all, and her husband could be treated and probably cured with radiotherapy. So if it's not cancer and not a germinoma, then the operation is safe, she said. But her voice tailed off uncertainly. I hesitated, not wanting to frighten her. I chose my words carefully. Yes, it makes it a lot less dangerous if I don't try to take it all out. We talked for a little longer before I wished them good night and went home. Early the next morning, I lay in bed thinking about the young woman I had operated on the previous week. She had had a tumour in her spinal cord between the 6th and 7th cervical vertebrae, and although I do not know why, since the operation had seemed to proceed uneventfully, she awoke from the operation paralysed down the right side of her body. I had probably tried to take out too much of the tumour. I must have been too sure of myself. I had been insufficiently fearful. I longed for this next operation, the operation on the pineal tumour, to go well, for there to be a happy ending, for everybody to live happily ever after, so that I could feel at peace with myself once again. But I knew that however bitter my regret, and however well the pineal operation went, nothing I could do would undo the damage that I had done to the young woman. Any unhappiness on my part was nothing compared to what she and her family were going through. There was no reason for this next operation on the pineal tumour to go well, just because I hoped so desperately that it would, or because the previous operation had gone so badly. The outcome of the pineal operation, whether the tumour was malignant or not, whether I could remove the tumour, or whether it was hopelessly stuck to the brain and everything went horribly wrong, was largely outside my control. I also knew that as time went by, the grief I felt at what I had done to the young woman would fade. The memory of her lying in her hospital bed with a paralysed arm and leg would become a scar rather than a painful wound. She would be added to the list of my disasters, another headstone in that cemetery which the French surgeon Lariche once said all surgeons carry within themselves. As soon as an operation begins, I usually find that any such morbid fear disappears. I take up the scalpel, no longer from the scrub nurse's hand, but, in accordance with some health and safety protocol, from a metal dish, and, full of surgical self-confidence, press it precisely through the patient's scalp. As the blood rises from the wound, the thrill of the chase takes over, and I feel in control of what is happening. At least, that is what usually happens. On this occasion, the disastrous operation of the preceding week meant that I came to the theatre suffering from severe stage fright. Instead of chatting, as I usually do, with the scrub nurse and Mike, one of the trainee surgeons known as specialist registrars who was assisting me, I cleaned the patient's skin and positioned the drapes in silence. Mike had been working with me for some months, and we knew each other well. I must have trained many registrars over the 30 years of my career, and with most of them I would like to think I've got on well. I'm there to train them, and must take responsibility for what they do, but they in turn are there to assist and support me and, when necessary, encourage me. I know well enough that they will usually only tell me what they think I want to hear, but it can be a very close relationship. A little, perhaps, like that between soldiers in battle, and it is what I will miss most when I retire. "What's up, boss?" Mike asked. I grunted through my face mask. The idea that neurosurgery is some kind of calm and rational appliance of science, I said, is such utter crap. At least it is for me. That bloody operation last week makes me feel as nervous as I was 30 years ago and not at all as though I was approaching retirement. Can't wait, said Mike. A standard joke the bolder of my registrars will make now that I am reaching the end of my career. There are currently more trainees than there are consultant jobs, and my trainees all worry about their future. Anyway, she'll probably get better, he added. It's early days. I doubt it, but you never know for certain. Well, I suppose that's true. We were standing behind the patient as we talked, since the unconscious, anaesthetized man was propped upright in the sitting position. Mike had already shaved a narrow strip of hair away from the back of his neck. Knife, I said to Agnes, the scrub nurse. I took it from the dish she held out to me and quickly cut down through the back of the man's head. Mike used a sucker to clear the blood away, and I then split the neck muscles apart so that we could start drilling through the bone of his skull. Really cool, said Mike. The man's scalp incised, the muscles retracted, a craniectomy of the skull performed, the meninges opened and reflected. Surgery has its own ancient descriptive language. I had the operating microscope brought in, and I settled down in the operating chair. With a pineal operation, unlike other brain tumours, you do not need to cut through the brain to reach the tumour. Instead, once you have opened the meninges, the membrane beneath the skull that covers the brain and spinal cord, you are looking along a narrow crevice that separates the upper part of the brain, the cerebral hemispheres from the lower part, the brain stem and cerebellum. You feel as though you are crawling along a long tunnel. At about 3 inches depth, although it feels 100 times longer because of the microscope's magnification, you will find the tumour. I'm looking directly into the centre of the brain, a secret and mysterious area where all the most vital functions that keep us conscious and alive are to be found. Above me, like the great arches of a cathedral roof, are the deep veins of the brain, the internal cerebral veins, and beyond them the basal veins of Rosenthal, and then in the midline the great vein of Galen, dark blue and glittering in the light of the microscope. This is anatomy that inspires awe in neurosurgeons. These veins carry huge volumes of venous blood away from the brain. Injury to them will result in the patient's death. In front of me is the granular red tumour, and beneath it the tectal plate of the brain stem, where damage can produce permanent coma. On either side are the posterior cerebral arteries, which supply the parts of the brain responsible for vision. Ahead, beyond the tumour, like a door opening into a distant white-walled corridor once the tumour has been removed, is the third ventricle. There is a fine surgical poetry to these names which, combined with the beautiful optics of a modern counterbalanced microscope, make this one of the most wonderful of neurosurgical operations. If all goes well, that is. On this occasion, as I approached the tumour, there were several blood vessels in the way that had to be cut. You need to know which can be sacrificed and which cannot. It was as though I had lost all my knowledge and experience. Every time I divided a blood vessel, I shook a little with fright. But as a surgeon, you learn at an early stage of your career to accept intense anxiety as a normal part of the day's work and to carry on despite it. An hour and a half into the operation, I reached the tumour. I removed a minute fragment to be sent off to the pathology laboratory, and I leaned back in my operating chair.